Good morning, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am the Reverend Sandra L. Ingham, better known as Sandy. You are welcome here, no matter what your beliefs, your ethnic or religious background, your sexual orientation, everyone is welcome. We do urge you to try to come more than one time if this is your first time here or one of your first times here, because our services can be different every week. They are done either by someone in our congregation, which will be the case this morning, or the services are sometimes done by outside people outside our society, and sometimes I do the service.
This is Ode to Catherine, written by Tara Converse for her mother, Kathy Converse. To her, when there is no light left, at the end of the day, her tired, soft hands reach out to touch my heart as no one else can. Her words soothe the fire within.
Thank you, Kathy.
Well, we have a story for kids now, so all the kids and whatever parents want to come up can come up and enjoy yourselves on the carpet here. Hi. Well, today's a very special day. What's the day? Mother's Day, sure. So for today's story, I'd like to tell you three short memories of my mom and me when I was a little girl. And the first story comes from when I was about 4 years old. Is anyone four here? Maybe not. Well, at that time, I lived in a little town called Waseca, and it's in Wisconsin. It's about 90 miles that way, and it's in a very hilly part of Wisconsin, hills, okay? So when I was four, we had a fire at our house. And my family, including myself and my parents and my little sister, who was just a baby, and I were all at church when it happened, fortunately. And there are four main things I remember about the fire. The first was that our cat was found swimming in the basement after the fire. Because, you know, they put a lot of water in there and it all went into the basement. And the second was I had to spend the night at an old lady's house, and she made me eat soda crackers in milk for breakfast, and I'd never heard of that, and it was too salty. And the third thing was that my parents were really happy that we were all at church and not in the house when it caught fire. And the fourth thing was that we had to move to another house while our house was being fixed. And that house was up the hill from our house, and there was a street there, and then the yard was below that, and it was on what was called Back Street. And we had a big cloud burst once when we were living in that house, and the water came pouring off the hills and off the street and down into our yard. And it brought a lot of sand with it too, because it was sandy there. And the water was about 4 inches deep in the yard. It was really deep.
I got the new one.
So now my mother always wore shoes and long stockings, I mean really long stockings, and I never saw her barefoot because she put me to bed before she undressed and went to bed, and then in the morning she got dressed before she came to see me, so I don't ever remember seeing her barefoot. But on this day, when it rained like that and there was water so deep in the yard, she took off her shoes and stockings and she had me take off my shoes and socks. And she took me by the hand and we went out wading in the water. And this was really exciting to me. One of the best memories of my childhood. It seemed like a miracle that my mother had feet just like mine, with toes and everything. And it was also a miracle that she would take me out to wade, you know, just like she was like a friend of mine. And I want to share two more memories. My bedroom was on the south side of the house, that's like that direction, and the sun would shine in on my bed in the daytime, in the morning. So my mother would come into my bedroom and she'd sit on the bed with me and she'd sing a song to me about the sunshine. And it goes like this, see if I can sing it. Merry, merry sunshine shining in our room. You've chased away the shadows and driven out the gloom. And my mother had a really high soprano voice, much higher than I was singing. And I loved that song, and I loved her singing to me. And then the last story is that my mother also played the piano. And sometimes to have fun with us kids, and there were seven of us in the family by the time she was through having kids. And she would play a march that's sometimes played for high school graduation. Can you imagine that in your mind? Pomp and circumstance. And she would play it good and loud, and we kids would march around in a circle in the living room. We would stomp, you might say. And we always begged her to play that song so we could enjoy stomping around in a circle to the music. And by the way, we were not allowed to dance in my family, so this is as close as we came to that.
Okay, well, let's see if we can get Aaron Bosch, Bill Parmenter, Reggie Butler, Eileen Middleton, Mary France, and maybe Rick Recchi all up here at the table to start. Well, happy Mother's Day to you all. As you can see, we have a many-voiced service planned for you today, and there's still some more voices who are out there. As we all know, our mothers had their gifts, and they also had their warts. They were examples to us. They taught us directly. They left their mark on us, which we display to this very day. And for us older people with mothers who are no longer with us, I know this will be a reminder of how we carry our mothers into our own generation and beyond. And for young mothers, which there are some I know, I know you'll be impressed with how important you are in developing your children's gifts and in shaping their way of being, because it's really true that's what happens. If I were to mention which of the seven UU principles we're illustrating in today's service, they would be primarily number one and number two. The first one is the inherent worth and dignity of every person, namely today, mothers and their children. And second, justice, equity, and compassion, especially compassion in human relations. And I know you'll find a lot to ponder in this service. And we'll begin with Aaron Bosch.
My mother, Elaine Moorhead, was born and raised in Chicago and graduated from high school during the Depression when there were no jobs to be had. So her mother said she might as well go to the local junior college, which had free tuition. She really enjoyed that experience, but it only lasted 1 year, and then there were jobs available again, so she started working at Commonwealth Edison in Chicago, which is where she met my father, who was 9 years older and a longtime bachelor. My mother liked to write poetry. She wrote beautiful poetry and silly, clever poetry. She was very intelligent and possessed of a very remarkable vocabulary, which is necessary to write poetry. A book of her poems is on the table. I don't know if Mary didn't mention that. There's all kinds of good stuff about all of our mothers on that table over there. My mother married my father when she was 22 and he was 31. They proceeded to have 5 children about a year apart. Then, after 8 years, I arrived. I'm sure she was not thrilled discovering she was pregnant again, but I never felt unwanted or unloved. My father died when I was 5 years old, and my mother was left with 6 children to raise. The bosses at the Edison Company called and offered her a job as a file clerk, and she took it. With the good union and with her getting promotions regularly, she did okay. We didn't have much money, but we weren't starving either. I think she was a great mother. She managed to give her children unconditional love. You didn't have to be smart or attractive or athletic to earn her love. She loved you just because you were you. Now, this trait did produce a few academic underachievers in our household. There probably would have been more A's on report cards had she been more demanding, but in the long run, what's the difference between an A and a B? How much more important to feel that you are loved with no strings attached? No achievements or prizes were necessary to gain her love. It was freely given. I have such a powerful memory of when I was about 5 or 6. I think that's the earliest memories. She can go back to age 4. That's really long. I must have done something naughty, been yelled at and sent to bed. Maybe I went angrily and yelled at her, "You don't love me." I don't clearly remember the prelude. But I do remember that a little later she came in and sat on my bed, hugged me to her hard, and said, "No matter how angry I get, don't ever, ever think that I don't love you." And she said that with so much intensity, like she really, really meant it. I'm sure that's why I remember it. She loved her children unconditionally and quite intensely, and she told us so. The unconditional love worked well for me. I think I was born with a self-correction mode. However, I think it didn't work quite so well for my brother. I think perhaps she should have told him when he was behaving badly, and maybe he would be a better person. As a parent myself, I found that to be such a tough line to walk. You want to love your children unconditionally, but sometimes they are not behaving that well. And someone has to tell them that. And that someone was me. And it can be hard. I do think my mother should have called my brother out on some of his stuff, but she never did. When we were having a 75th birthday party for my mother, I asked the guests to write out memories of her and bring them to the party to compile in a book, which is also on the table over there. Here are some of my favorites. My sister Denise wrote, "My mother and my husband Jack's mother were babysitting for the kids while I was out of town for a few days. When I returned, my mother and Jack's mother were engaged in characteristic activities. Jack's mother had the kitchen all cleaned up after dinner and was sweeping the floor. My mother was seated at the dining room table playing poker with the kids for money." My sister's high school girlfriend wrote, "During the sharp edges of adolescence, Mrs. Moorhead created an image of motherhood that I have cherished to this day. Unscheduled meals, book discussions, playwriting, and dancing in the living room all evoke memories of a warm and witty person who shared herself with a young girl, delighted to experience all that seemed unconventional in a family. She showed me that a mother can create her own image, and it can be as unusual and unique as the person." Once my mother contacted the local parish priest and volunteered our house as a gathering place for young adults, since the parish did not offer that. He declined. She said, "I think he thinks I'm too libertarian and doesn't trust me." But she did invite younger co-workers to our house to play charades, and when I was about 10 years old, I was allowed to play too and was pretty good at it. My mother was fun.
Yeah. Thank you, Lauren. Well, John France's mother, John is sitting back in the corner back there, Amy Kellogg was a divinity school graduate. She used her education to be a good mother and to teach Sunday school. And the first reading about John France's mother is a memoir by another person, Dan Wakefield, who is one of the children in Amy France's Sunday school class. Bill Parmenter will read this.
"My parents took me to Sunday school at the First Presbyterian Church. The minister was the Reverend George Arthur France, who seemed an appropriate earthly representative of that thunderous biblical God who laid down laws that were written on stone and punished people who didn't obey them. We Sunday school children were spared the forbidding prospect of the Reverend France himself as our teacher, and were thankfully delivered by our parents instead into the gentler arms of his wife Amy. She was the warm and comforting embodiment of the God of mercy. I remember her in red, a large, round, shining apple of a woman, brown hair pulled back in a bun, face scrubbed and glowing, eyes lively and glinting, mouth in a smile that seemed a genuine expression of delight at being a believer in and a bearer of the good news of Christianity. I can't recall a child ever crying in Amy's Sunday school. Children were instinctively calmed by the sense of love and warmth that seemed to spread around her like a comforting blanket. Grown-ups, I learned later, considered her a little bit touched. I think it might have been partly because of her style. She spoke in a melodic voice and with perfect diction that people I knew then might consider a bit hoity-toity or uppity. But most important of all, she took the lessons of her Christian religion as literal and seemed to apply them in her everyday life. Really loving your neighbor as yourself, turning the other cheek, doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. One of the main lessons I remember from Amy's Sunday school was that God loved everyone regardless of race, creed, or color. I remember it not only because of her words, but because of a painting reproduction that hung on the wall of our Sunday school room, and probably every many, many, many other Sunday school rooms in this country. Jesus was holding the children. They were not only white like me, they came in all colors. Jesus loved them all. You can see that clearly from the picture, and Amy told us so. There were no real children of other colors in my Sunday school class, but simply to have such a picture displayed and to instruct little kids about equality was radical in those days. It was only a picture, but it made a lasting impression on me. It came again to my mind when I went for the first time to Spanish Harlem, a few years after graduating from college. Even when, as a practicing intellectual atheist, I had thought I had put Christianity out of my mind, that picture stayed in it. Again, when I covered the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s in the South, traveling for The Nation magazine to places like the Mississippi Delta, Birmingham, and Little Rock, I kept seeing that old Sunday school picture in my head, and it meant something not only because of what it showed, but because of what Amy had said about it. She told us that Jesus loved all the children, no matter what color they were, and he wanted us to love them too, and I believed her. Even when I no longer believed in Jesus, I believed in Amy and the lesson she taught us.
Well, John also contributed a memory of his mother, and listen to how his divinity school mother handled John's counterfeiting abilities.
This is titled A Battlefield Commission as Robin Hood. At the age of 8 or 9, I liberated some plaster of Paris from a dentist's trash in our neighborhood. I made molds for casting lead objects. The most successful were buffalo nickels that were good enough to pass. I didn't even try to pass them, but I gave a few of them to Kimmy, our long-term family maid. There happened to be a homemade illegal slot machine near her house. And it also just happened that my nickels hit the jackpot every time she put one in. Kimmy was clever enough not to use too many of them, and she split the take with me to keep them coming. The amazing part of the story is that when my mother found out about the entire adventure, I became a hero for protecting the poor blacks from exploitation by the greedy white merchants. The title of this item, A Battlefield Commission as Robin Hood, is paraphrased from my mother. Neither Kimmy nor I received any sanction from any source, and neither of us went on to pursue a life of crime. So far. Vindicating my mother's assessment of events, all mothers are special. Some are more than others, of course. My mother had an advanced degree in theology.
And on the table, there's a picture of John and his mother when John was just probably 3 years old or so. Shows her reading Gulliver's Travels, or maybe before she started reading, and it's one way he learned multi-syllable words, which if you know John, you know, he knows a lot of them. So now you might understand where his abilities came from. And now for a change of pace, I'd like to ask Metchie Butler to read a poem about what she learned from her mother, and we'll recognize how her mother's philosophy shaped her as well.
I wrote this when my mom died in order to tell friends and relatives that she had passed. And so that's what this really was. It was an obituary. Harriet Mason Kaplan was her name. There's a little vase over there that has a story to it. If I have time later, I can tell you that story. To my mother. My mother taught me beauty. She taught me living things. In all the small, the great, the all, the memory of her clings. Her beauty is a misty day of grays and creams and blues. The forms and silvered textures there are written in the hues. And life's a tiny creature, so terrified with fright, to study into gentle and release into the night, to watch to slip to safety and to freedom with its kind, to teach appreciation and with tenderness remind that all of us here but a while must peacefully abide within the needs of everyone, a balance to provide, that each of us dependent on each other form must learn to love and live together and a piece of love discern. My mother's memory lingers in the beauty all about, and there her way of thought will feed my way of life throughout.
Thanks, Betsy. So Mary France is going to talk about processions of mothers and more.
Okay. I like to think of the procession of mothers. Going back to my mother, my grandmothers, and the one great-grandmother I can vaguely remember, in the forward march of our own daughters, grandchildren, and the increasing profusion of great-grandchildren. who I hope will remember me better than I remember my great-grandmother. What did I learn from these mentoring foremothers? Well, they obviously loved their children and took good care of them, but at the same time there was fun and mutual enjoyment of one another's company and shared activities. My mother and her sister and their parents were water enthusiasts. I should say their mother, not their father. And the three families shared a big summer home on beautiful Highland Lake in Connecticut. Nana taught each of the six grandchildren to swim before they could walk, so we were considered competent to canoe or row all over the large lake without adult supervision. However, Mother loved to go too, so we often shared those aquatic activities with her. The lake was a women and children place all week, and the working dads showed up only on weekends, but we had lots of fun then. Our year-round home on Long Island was between Long Island Sound and the South Shore ocean beaches. So on many summer days, Mother would say, let's buzz through the housework and go to the beach in the afternoon. And we'd work and then play together. From her, I learned the pleasure of working and playing as a family. And that carried through to our lives with our own children. Both my parents loved music, attending concerts, opera, occasional theater in New York City from time to time. I was included from an early age. Radio, of course, was free. We listened to the Met every Saturday afternoon and the New York Philharmonic every Sunday. Mother always treated our ideas and opinions as important and discussed what we saw or heard with us. Interestingly, I have few memories of being treated as a child. Instead, the boys and I learned to be grown-ups by being part of the going concern, which was the family. Values were taught by example, frequent discussion of current events. In my elementary school years, the country went through the Great Depression. We were raised to be thrifty. My dad called it reading the menu from right to left. And most of our pleasures were simple ones. We were taught concern for others and consideration of social justice, though church and formal religion were not a part of their lives. I think they were basically humanists. If there had been a prairie congregation, we might have been part of it, and wouldn't that have been fine? Mother was a close and loving daughter to her own parents. I remember daily postcards back and forth with her mother over many years, until my parents went into the Foreign Service and lived overseas after World War II. In fact, I had to continue the postcards for some time after they went overseas. But then, while overseas, she wrote voluminous letters describing everything they saw and did in various countries. And her father would laboriously type carbons for all the rest of us. Do you remember carbon paper? Having my mother far away as my babies came along was difficult. Letters don't substitute for a grandmotherly lap. But in my life, too, I have not been able to be an on-site grandma. And her example showed me how much the older generation can contribute to the growing world of young people despite lack of proximity. Perhaps one of Mother's greatest lessons was how to be part of a couple. She was her own person, but unquestionably put her marriage first. The further example of my father's reciprocal respect for her individuality made me see them both as feminists from the beginning, before the word was invented. It never occurred to them or to me and my brothers that we wouldn't all three have the same opportunities in life.
Okay, thank you. Molly Plunkett and Ann Lundeen and Peter Addison, come up and join the table.
Could I go next, please, Mary? Could I go next?
Could you go next?
Yeah.
All right. Wasn't the plan that you could go next. Well, I'll give a little introduction to you. If we're lucky, we have our mothers in their own right minds until they die of old age. But that doesn't... we don't know Rick Recchi necessarily as a sports fan, but his mother was. I found that out. And you'll notice a similarity between Rick's mother and John's mother in the way they treated infractions of the rules.
Mother was the sports fan in our family, and baseball was her game.
radio broadcast of St. Louis Cardinal games filled the house all summer. When the paper was left open to the sports page, we knew Mother had been checking the league standings. Mother learned baseball under the tutelage of her father, who had started a medical practice as the house doctor of the Chicago Athletic Club. They lived near St. Louis, and Dr. Bennett took her with our Uncle Dick to many major league games at Sportsman's Park, back when it was home to both the Browns and the Cards. Dick was a whiz at baseball statistics and became a newspaper sports writer, while Mother preferred the game's personalities and their anecdotes. She regaled us with stories of players such as Ray Schalk, who came from our hometown, Litchfield, Illinois, George Sisler, the Gas House Gang, later Satchel Paige, or Baby Doll Johnson. She once saw Baby Doll foul off 27 straight pitches to wear out an opposing pitcher, back when players practiced such skills. Mother was a big fan of Branch Rickey for bringing Jackie Robinson into Major League Baseball, and also because before he headed to Brooklyn, Rickey managed both the Browns and the Cards. On television, she once watched my brother Bill chase a foul ball on opening day at Wrigley Field when he was supposed to be in his ninth grade class. She appreciated that spunk and later took him out of school so they could both see Stan the Man Musial play his last game in Chicago. My mother was a baseball fan, and her name was Helene. And I have to go downstairs.
Well, I'd like to share some memories of my mother from her middle years. You already heard from when I was a child. And my mother's name is Mary Catherine Miller, or Mary Kay for short, and I get my first name from her. I get my other name from my other grandmother. Well, I've had to make up an important image of my mother from the handwritten talk that she made to a group of women in another state when she was in her mid-40s or so. Starting in 1940, the University of Wisconsin sponsored rural art shows around the state. Our whole family participated in the late 1940s and early 50s. Mom was awarded the best in the show in 1950, the first year she entered with her primitive style painting, and there's a picture over there. It was called Our Girls Praying. We three oldest girls are in bright red nightgowns, kneeling by the four-poster bed with white striped blue and white flannel sheets. When she painted that picture, she was afraid she would not live to see us grown, and was looking for a way to convey to us how to get along if she died. Well, first of all, she taught me at 9 years, 8 or 9 years old how to make breakfast for everybody. She told her audience of women, and so it was laid on my heart to paint this picture to tell our girls that in prayer to God they could find their greatest comfort, love, and help in life. Speaking of her painting that was over 300 entries, was one of over 300 entries, she said, mine looked very homely among the artistic array. But something made the judges come back to her painting time after time in that hall, despite its errors in perspective and its use of unmixed primary colors. Ladies, she said, I believe it was the Lord speaking to them through that picture. It was a deep experience put down in paint. You can do the same in your way. So then she encouraged her audience of women to express themselves in paintings, telling them they would get the joy of expression which copying can never give. After that first painting, my mother painted many more, most of family members, and one of them is hanging up there. So then I want to skip forward to an image of my mother when there were no longer any children at home. As the oldest, and that's me, sometimes you get that job of squiring your mother around. Mom wanted to visit her relatives in Kentucky. I was chosen, and I wasn't looking forward to the chore. Well, it turned out it was no chore at all. So we took off in the car together with no children to take Mom's attention and no husband to keep happy. Mom turned into a delightful young companion. She was no longer my mother trying to teach a daughter how to be a good girl. Decades of responsibility dropped away from her. And I could see what a wonderful friend she must have been before turning into a minister's wife with 7 children. I really liked that young, unencumbered adult, and I felt sad that that person had been totally hidden from me when she became my mother, or rather I should say when she became the mother of so many. After my mother died, I had a lot of time in her house cleaning and clearing it. This last image is from that time. I'm in the empty dining room. Now that the clashing green flowered wallpaper has been painted white and the furniture is gone, the red carpet is the main feature. But I can still see my mother at her place at the head of the table with the kitchen behind her. She's in a flashy red holiday dress. She's still in possession of all her faculties. She offers the extemporaneous prayer and leads the song we often used at the table when we were together as a young family. For balmy sunshine, for nourishing rain, dear Lord, for thy goodness we thank thee. Our food and thy care, rich blessings we share, the proof of thy love, and we thank thee. We thank thee, O God. Well, if we're lucky, we do have our mothers in their own right minds until they die of old age. My mother only lost her memory when she was in the last 3 or 4 months. But that doesn't always happen. Kathy Converse has written of her mother who had Alzheimer's when Kathy was just in her early 50s, and Ann Lundeen is going to read that poem.
Mary, what thoughts flow through this tousled gray head that cause the frown on her face? Thoughts of today, of remembering then? Do I fit into these thoughts? My touch different, my words more tender, my mom received differently than their Mary? Or am I truly a forgotten daughter, caring without returned passion, without thanks, without hugs and kisses? This isn't my mother anymore, this cranky, ungrateful woman who doesn't appreciate my time and efforts, doesn't recognize my accomplishments, doesn't grandmother my children. The mother I knew has faded. I am caring for this woman, Mary, usually a total stranger to me, but still, those unexpected fleeting moments, a certain look, a hand gesture, maybe a word or two, that brings realization and grips my heart. Wait, this Mary is my mother. I kiss her soft wrinkled cheek, smooth her tousled hair, hold the thin veined hand with a tear in my eye, remain devoted, forever bound by forces started 53 years ago.
I think maybe Molly Plunkett is having a little bit of some of that kind of experience with her mother. She said to me when she wanted to read this that she wanted to read it because she wanted to be able to tell her mother she was reading it, but that her mother would probably forget in a very short time. But it's a happier memory. Molly.
Okay. Yeah, my mother is fading also. She's 91, and I'm the oldest of 6 children. And this, I've written stories about different holidays for her. This is adapted some because it was too long and it may be a little choppy. We call my mom Tiggy, from Tiggy the Tiger from Winnie the Pooh, because she had so much energy when she was young. Christmas is prime time for the Tigster. She has always loved the smell of cut pine boughs and our traditional all-blue Christmas tree lights. At the height of her formless, porous primeval period, there would be pine boughs wound through the stair rails with some light strung just below the handrail. Pine bough ropes framing a wreath above the mantel. Pine bough ropes hanging down from the mantel. Pine bough ropes draping the radiator cover under the front windows in both the living room and the dining room. Pine boughs were arranged around the hall mirror. Pine boughs graced every table surface. Some arrangements included candles or tiny elf figures nestled in tableaus. A table in the corner of the living room closest to the tree was reserved for the nativity scene. Amazingly, the plastic figure seemed to survive year after year. Peggy adapted the crèche for Minnesota. It was a northern Bethlehem stable with cotton batten balls, rolls of snow covering the roof, and pine boughs behind the stable. We would move the figures around like a dollhouse. The crèche was still there for grandchildren to play with. Two-year-old Maggie Fay, who's my oldest child, who had neither religious training nor actual knowledge of the Christmas story, studied the crèche carefully during one of her first Christmas visits, and then she loudly asked Grandma, "Why did they put the baby Jesus in a nest?" Christmas was Tiggy's major discipline tool. It was what we kids looked forward to from the time we finished our Halloween candy. The closer it got to Christmas, the more often the babysitter's reports on our behavior would reflect on the volume of presents under the tree for each kid. Often the reports were bad. One grisly year, there were actually no toys. Tiggy was at pains to give each kid exactly the same number of presents as the other five. Late Christmas Eve, she would stack the presents up for each kid. If anyone was short, she would make a midnight or 1 or 2 a.m. dash to Super America, the original all-night convenience store. More feverish wrapping until she'd run out of scotch tape and back to Super America. Christmas morning, there'd be an avalanche of presents. At the end of the opening of the Christmas melee, orphan presents would remain under the tree. Tiggy would look hard at each present, maybe shake it a little, peer under the wrapping, and then pronounce that this is for Jim. By this time, the living room was a wreck. We'd have to pick a path through rubble of toys, boxes, and paper. Many years, no doubt, the resident beagle would have been sniffing through the remains for anything edible. The stockings on the chimney were saved for last because although there was occasionally some candy, the items usually small enough to fit in the socks tended to be practical, like pens or socks. A major Tiggy life theorem was that you could never have too many socks. Christmas Eve was the time that Tiggy served unusual cookies or snacks. I'm sorry, Christmas Eve, or snacks that otherwise were never seen in our kitchen. Pickled herring, tiny shrimp, sardines, fancy cheeses. Dad would build a roaring fire in the fireplace, and by the end of the night, the downstairs of our two-story house would be freezing because the fire had sucked out all the heat in the house. During our earliest Christmas Eves, Tiggy orchestrated the annual family Christmas pageant. Every child had a role in the nativity story. Age paid, and the oldest children usually grabbed the starring roles of the narrator or Mary and Joseph. My mother also determined it when we were older and took ballet and gymnastic lessons that Christmas Eve was the time for home recitals. Those years, she wanted to see what all those years of lessons had produced. My sister and I would put on back leotards and tights, soft pink ballet slippers, and maybe even figure out some kind of tutu. We whirled and jumped without much talent to the music of the Nutcracker Ballet. The boys, apparently, had no talent that they were required to put on display. Still later, as when we were older, Tiggy decreed that we would read the nativity story when we were too old to act it out and nobody could fit in the manger anymore, or a Dickens story aloud. And then we had to reflect on something important we'd learned during the year. There was always no rush among the kids to speak first. Finally, when we were older, we would go caroling as a family, fueled by too much wassail. when we could all legally drink. There were a few Christmas Eves that I'm sure are quite memorable for our neighbors, when we would offer to sing or provide a service because we were carrying a vacuum cleaner. It was a wonderful night for us at every age, and I'm trying to carry through some rituals the same for my family.
Okay, finally we'll end with Peter Anderson talking about how he got to know his mother better when she was dying, but he's going to talk about some other things too. And I think we might not appreciate our mothers till we get older, because we're kind of at loggerheads for them, with them for quite a bit of our lives, but when they get to the point where we have to be the mother to them, then it changes and we realize what they offer to us. So Peter, 3 minutes, so we have a few minutes to talk.
Yes, truer words were never said. You really don't know your parents until it comes time for them to pass from your lives. My mom, I never called her mom, I called her Sylvie. When I was 2, I heard her friends talking to her and calling her Sylvie, so I just piped up and said Sylvie. Everyone laughed and thought it was cute, and that has encouraged me, and my mother never objected, because at least at that time in her life she was very modern, and she thought it was cute too. Though later in life she wanted to be called Mom, and by that time I'd become so habituated, I didn't know how. I mean, she would even, I remember when the 60s came and she would say to me, "You think your generation discovered free love?" But she was, the word Jewish mother was coined, I think, for my mom. She was fierce demands and even fiercer love. It was unbelievable. Though the funny thing is, she was also, like many people are here, a ranting atheist. We once had a Thanksgiving dinner, and my cousin, who was who had started life as an atheist too, wound up with her husband Ray as devout Jesus freaks. And we were having dinner, and Karen was trying to convince my mother to become religious, and she knew my mother was not going to be converted, so she had a good moral story to tell, that Ray had a terrible toothache, and he couldn't stand it. He went to the dentist couldn't do anything for him. And they got down their hands and knees and they prayed, and the toothache went away. And my mother looked at Karen and said, "Millions dying of starvation in Bangladesh, the world on the brink of nuclear conflagration, and all God has time for is Ray's tooth." But by the same token, she was always upwardly mobile, with great determination. And my father was not. He had no interest in that. And after one party where she had cooked up a real repast to blow everyone away, my father was doing the dishes, and he was just not thinking. He was washing the silverware with Comet. And my mother freaked out when she saw her whole middle class aspiring life ripple away. And I was supposed to be asleep at the time. I never heard a fight as terrible as that fight. And it was the only time in my life that I got down and prayed. It's a little. The thing, though, I come about in terms of this point in my life, where I've been a very strong environmental activist, though, is for all the things that drove me absolutely nuts, I have to admit that the drive that I have that drives the polluters nuts is something that she left in me. And then it came to her last chapter, and at that point she had a succession of mini strokes that robbed her mind, and she was in an assisted living. There's a picture there in the back, the large one. And I learned so well what you can give back to your mom when that time comes for her. We would go to visit her every day. Jed would come with me at the Meritor, and all the women would be sitting around pretty much doing not much of anything, and Jade would pour through the door and go, "Grandma!" and run over to her and sit down at the chair next to her and put his head on her shoulder, and it meant just $1 million to her. Though there came a time very soon thereafter that a memory went so badly that she no longer remembered Jed or me. And so I would just talk to her about the times in her life that were good and some of the memories that I remembered her talking about. She always used to love the Beatles song, The End, which has that little riff about, I said, remember some of the Beatles song, the love you give is equal to the love you get. And even though she had been in this near coma for about a week before, she came alive and said, no, the love you take is equal to the love you make, which I went back and looked and she was exactly right. I don't know where this came from. After she died, we had a time to remember for her, and one of the people in the building where she had lived came up to me and said she always thought of Sylvia as always dressed to the nines. She never came out of her apartment without being completely made up. And it made me remember that the story she had mentioned, which had no context at the time, is she thought of herself as an ugly duckling. Her brother was handsome, and the teachers in school would say, oh, you're the smart one, he's the pretty one. And she, I think, in terms of the things that stay with you from age 4 or 5 on, she, her whole life, in terms of upwardly mobile and always being dressed, was a residue of those terrible wounds that she had felt so long ago. So that's why I say, I think we don't really know our parents until it comes time for them to pass from our lives. And I can't sing like Mary. So in honor of my mom. Oops. Thanks for listening.
I've got a postscript on his mother, who at the memorial service, the same woman who said she was always so beautifully dressed, said she'd come out of her unit at Meritor in the morning and she'd see Sylvie beautifully dressed and groomed, and she'd decide she looked too shabby. She'd go back in and change.
Well, so we're at about 11 minutes after.
As we go from this place, let us remember our mothers and all we learned from them. May it be so. Go in peace and take time to greet your neighbors.